The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
She's going to tell me what to do.
Well, first I'm going to tell everybody what we've done. Hello again. I was going to give you a little history of how the book came about so that you can have it in a bit of a context. I was at a concert at Disney Hall about 5 years ago, and Frank Gehry said, I want to talk to you about something. Do you think you could give me a call tomorrow? So, I mean, what's the answer? Yes, of course. So I went to see him, and he told me that he was interested in doing an oral history, that at that point he was 75 years old, and he was thinking about getting everything down, you know. And this is 5 years later, and we've done a lot of that, right? We got a lot of it down.
There's a lot more.
There's a lot more. And so... he asked me to do this because I've been interviewing him now for more than 20 years, and I've written about him for newspapers. I followed the construction of Disney Hall for the Los Angeles Times. I wrote about the MIT building for Esquire. He was a major character in my last book, major figure in my last book. And so
Characters, okay.
So we have been meeting pretty regularly for these past, four or five years. And I would go to the office at Gehry Partners, where he works. And I wanted to kind of give you a sense of where we would meet, because it'll make reading the book even more enjoyable, I think. And in his office, which has glass on three walls, we would sit there at the conference table. And on the conference table would be, say, a model of a building he was working on, photographs from a building under construction somewhere else, perhaps a prototype of something for Tiffany's or another product that he might be working on, many oranges, usually peeled, his telephone, which would vibrate constantly as we spoke.
It's a BlackBerry.
His BlackBerry. And then we would just chat. And I thought we could sort of do the same thing here this evening. So I thought we would begin by some of your influences. And we can go all the way back to childhood and your relationship with your grandparents, which I find thrilling. And what do you think? You want to talk about that?
My grandparents... came from Poland, 1913, to Canada. Right? I was just in the town where they came from last year, and they asked me to write. It's Lodz, L-O-D, Woods, it's pronounced. And they asked me to write something on this wall that people did something. So I wrote, my grandfather left here in 1913. If he hadn't left, I wouldn't be here. I got all kinds of letters and calls after that. Well, I mean, these stories seem so old already. I've told them so many times. My grandmother was a hardworking lady that used to cook on a wood cook stove in Toronto, and my grandfather had a hardware store around the corner, and she would cook and take stuff to him. To get wood for the cook stove, she went to the wood shop back down the alley, and I used to go with her, and she'd get these sacks of, you can probably still do it, sacks of wood cuttings in all wonderful shapes. And I don't know what got into her. She would spill them on the floor with me and sit there, sit on the floor. I mean, she must have been in her, must have been at least 60 already, but, and she would make cities with me. And it was, that's after when I was growing up later and didn't know what I really wanted to be when I grew up. And I thought I wanted to be a chemical engineer. And, I met a few chemical engineers, and they convinced me I didn't want to do that. And then, you know, a confusing time. We'd moved to L.A. I was 18. I was driving a truck. It was a bad time financially for the family. And I went to night school. And I kept remembering this thing with my grandmother. Something just kept going. And then a teacher in an extension class in ceramics was building a house with a fairly famous architect in L.A., Rafael Soriano. And Glenn Lukens was the teacher's name. And he invited me to come visit the construction site. I think it was very intuitive of him. The ceramic stuff I was doing was pretty awful, so he probably thought, what am I going to do with this guy? And I went there, and this guy in a beret and dressed all in black like I am.
Coincidence.
A broken nose. He was from the Isle of Rhodes, and he was telling the guys where to put the steel, and it was so romantic, you know, seeing this steel go up and everything. And we got back to the next day in class, and Glenn called me over and said, I think you should try the architecture class. There's one on Monday nights. I think I can get you in. And he did. And I'm sure he paid for the class, because I didn't have the money. And that was about the third project into that, maybe a couple of months into it. I was getting some approvals from people that I just thought, wow. And the bug got me. While I was doing that, I was visiting every building in Southern California by an architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, Soriano, Neutra, Schindler, the younger people. I spent time. I met during that period. I met Julius Schulman, the photographer, and he also lived in a Soriano house. I think that's how I met him, through Soriano, and he let me come out photographing with him. And he introduced me to a lot of the architects, I was hooked. I was in. I was ready to go. I got skipped into second year architecture, into the real thing. And at the end of my first project in second year, I was so excited. My teacher called me in and said, "This ain't for you, kid." So that guy became the architect for LAX. And I kept running into him. And he would say, "Don't say it, I know." But I love teaching. I teach every other year at Yale. That's how this young lady, Megan Lloyd, graduated there 8 or 9 years ago. And I have a lot of Yalees in my office. But that incident taught me, you never tell anybody they don't know. You never do that. There's so much potential. And, you know, you get a class of 14 kids usually in a master's class. And usually only two of them are really got the juice. That are really exciting. Then there's a couple more that look possible. And then, but they're very intelligent, they're very dedicated, and there's always something. And I've noticed over the years that they find their ways into being historians, they become writers, they become, they do a lot of things, and the architecture seeps out somehow. And so there's no, you know, if you want to become somebody that does what I do, then that's a smaller group that go there. But there's so much more to it. There's so much more, many more parts that require the sensibilities and that they pick up in architecture school. So I think it's a, I would never say that to any student, but that guy said to me. You can, if you think about it, you can find, you know, if you know that, you can dig a little when you're teaching them and find what they get, what the light bulbs go on, like my ceramic teacher did. You can explore. I mean, I try to do that a lot with the students. I try to figure out who they are and let that come out and then try to nurture that.
I think it would be good, too, to talk about what Los Angeles was like at that time, because Los Angeles then and even today is such a place of freedom and experimentation. And for so long people felt that nobody was really looking at them, so they could take risks they couldn't take in other parts of the country. So how did that influence you, being in Los Angeles? If, you know, at that time,
well, the
we're talking the early 60s now, kind of when you get out of, I guess the 50s when you get out of school.
50s, yeah. There was one magazine, Arts and Architecture, John Intenza, and it was dedicated to a certain kind of architecture. And it was, and they picked, like Craig Ellwood was the hero, one of the heroes. And Soriano, the one I talked about, was one of the heroes. And there wasn't much wiggle room for shifting ideas in that. And I remember Julius Shulman got me to design a house for his brother-in-law when I graduated. And I had the teachers in my school had just come back, returning GIs, and they'd been to Japan and they'd seen the classical Japanese stuff. And it was very enticing because you could, in Southern California, you could build with wood and like that. And it was easy, and there was a lot of stuff going up with wood, what they called dingbats, the tract houses all over the place. And so it was easy to get carpenters to do that kind of thing, and it was very inexpensive. You could put them up quick. And the Japanese model worked. And so I was really into that. So this little house I did kind of looked like one of those guys. It looked very Japanese. And I remember I took it to John Intenza because Julius was very proud that I was doing it. And John Intenza wouldn't even talk to me about it. So there, you know, so it was that kind of thing that you couldn't, there was no freedom in the culture to play. When I did the little Danziger studio, the architects who I knew, who were friends, railed against it. They thought it was it wasn't part of the fold. It was different. It was different.
Now, did that lead you then to the artists?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
It took me, and I was hanging out with artists a little bit at the time, and when that building was going up, so I don't know if you know these names, but Ed Moses, Larry Bell, Kenny Price, Billy Al Bengston, etc., were the LA art scene, the Ferris Gallery group. And they used to come, because they were interested in ideas. And I would see, I didn't know them. I'd meet them on the construction site. And we became friends, and I found that much, much nicer haven to be in for me than these architects who were committed to some kind of stylistic thing that they thought was the only way to do things. The artists were freer. Nobody said what was right or wrong. They were hands-on. They were intuitive. They worked hard. They were craftsmen. They were struggling for their own identities, for their own, and their languages were quite different, all of them. And I found that very exciting, so I stayed in that culture for a long time, and still.
I was going to say, you still are in that culture, aren't you?
And it was through that I met, you know, all the people of my generation, Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns and Klaus Oldenburg and so on. And
I
stay away from the, like, New York. It wouldn't have happened for me in New York, because or even if I'd have stayed in Canada, it wouldn't have. Canada was too gray and neutral and everything, as far as architecture was concerned. And New York, it was too much inbreeding with the New York Five and all that stuff. And they had a sort of a lock on things. And nobody paid attention out in L.A. Nobody. The magazines didn't come out. And I think that's a... I tell everybody, don't get in the middle of that other stuff, because the publicity and things are temporal. They're not really important to your... I mean, in the end, they help you get jobs, but the jobs... You better have your language together, have your ideas, and that's what gets you to do things, finally.
I like how not just the artists have inspired you, but actual paintings and sculpture has inspired you. Just even the cover of the book, you're going to get, the top half of the book are sketches that he made for this project in Dusseldorf, which has three parts to it. And the building itself was inspired in part by Giorgio Morandi's bottle villages, and in part by a Renaissance painting, the Madonna and Child with Saints. Now, I mean, the notion that you could constantly be absorbing all of these things and then somehow
the Madonna and Child thing is an easy one. Look.
Okay.
There she is, Mary, the little guy sitting on her lap. Think of it now in a building, you know, a tall building with the little pavilion in front.
He's serious. I know you think he's joking. His man is serious.
No, but it's a model that other people use. I'm just saying it's not, I didn't invent that idea, but it's obvious. And if you look at Morandi, it's like a conglomeration of little buildings. All still lifes are like that. They're, if you look at them that way, they are. They're, you know.
Oh, talk about the one-room building, because I think that's I think that's really interesting, and I've never heard anyone else talk about it. The simplicity of it.
Well, I had a great friend, you all knew, Philip Johnson, who was a great mentor of mine, and he was a mentor to a lot of my generation. There's nobody replaced him in that role in our architectural world right now. There's nobody that is mentoring as much as he was, is spending much time. Anyway, he gave a lecture a long time ago about the one-room building, and that moved me, because I was fascinated with how do you get to the moment of truth? The moment of truth I called when an artist faces the white canvas. I mean, you fantasize this. It's got the thing with the colors. There's the white canvas. What do I do? And that moment of truth, whether it's done that way or not, it does exist for every artist. It's what? And for architecture, we have programs that are complex and circulation systems and roofing and walls and windows and doors and stuff like that. And there's a lot of places to hide, a lot of excuses. You know, I had to do this because, or I had to do this because. And the one room, when I heard Philip talk about that, it clicked. You know, of course, that's the simplest model, and that's the closest to the white canvas as you can get as an architect, I think. So it's got to be X wide, high. I mean, everything is up for discussion in making one room building. And then when you think about the one room buildings in history, Chartres Cathedral, Notre Dame, some of the greatest buildings,
Ronchamp.
You realize how much freedom there is there. And since I was interested in Mirandi, and Mirandi obviously is a group of buildings, and if you're doing a house, so you got a living room, a dining room, a kitchen, a bedroom, each one of those can be a one-room building. So if you get a house to do, you've got 10 white canvases to confront. And then you got to put them together. And I did a bunch of studies like that, did some early houses like that. And the one that got built that was better known is the Winton House, which ironically was a guest house to Philip Johnson's house in Minneapolis, outside of Minneapolis, in Wayzata. But that's what turned me on. That's what got my language going. I studied city planning at Harvard. I wanted to do that. I'm a do-gooder, liberal, you know, lefty, all this shit. Anyway, I'm not that bad, but I am. I knee-jerk that way. So I didn't want to do rich guys' houses. That didn't appeal to me. And I don't do them. I can't even do my own house now that I'm rich.
What's your favorite moment when you're working on a project? You know, the time that you call it the candy store. When everything?
Well, it takes a while to understand a client's program. So if you're doing any building, you know, like Disney Hall, there's so much baggage that comes with that, the acoustics, the sight lines, the seating, the back of house, the backstage, the foyer, the food service, the parking access, the relation to the streets. And every project has tons of complexity like that. And I build models of the site, and I build models of the surroundings, so that even the Philadelphia Museum, which we're working on, where everything I'm going to do is going to, except for a loading dock, is going to be underground. My loading dock is going to be visible from every place. I made a model of that building and all the surroundings. So if you came to my office, you could see the parkway, the Perlman building, the road between, I don't remember all the names. I go all the way to the river and down the edge and down the hill into the garden. And I build it at 2 or 3 scales. So it's not, I mean, a really big one and then smaller scale one. And the reason I keep several scales going is so that I don't get hung up with the artifacts of the process. In other words, the drawings and the models I make, I don't want them to be the object of desire. I want the building to be. And so by having these different scales to work on, it forces me to shift in my thinking and keep the reality in here. That's a thing I learned a long time ago, and it has worked. And so once I get those models built, and I understand the relationship to everything, and I understand the program and what absolutely has to be accomplished, and that's all vetted with the client and many meetings, as we have with the museum and with the board and with the staff, and we do that on every project. And when we know all that stuff, when it's like second nature, then I call that the candy store, because I know now I can move. Now I can, I got enough things. I'm not going to run into trouble. I have a fancy computer system that we've developed where I use it to analyze floor area, interior volume, and exterior surface. And with those three things, as I model, I constantly have the models checked. I can control the cost of the building because I know the ratios of floor area to exterior and all that stuff that are reasonable for certain budgets. And even though we can't control the economy or the commodities or things like that, the price of copper, the price of steel, labor costs, we can pretty much quantify and analyze the bits and pieces as we're designing so that when we get to the end, we're more likely to be close to the budget. And sometimes, a few times, we've been under budget, like Bilbao was $5 million, out of a $100 million building was $5 million under. And Gail Harity is here. She was there. But it's, I think those things are important. What bothers me in the architectural process is that, you know, we got lots of people with lots of talent. We get lots of ideas. Clients fall in love with their architects. You got to be friends. You got to play together. And then the rude awakening when you put out the bid and it costs too much, and then the client has to take a deep breath and say, now what do I do? And the contractor is always there, and the architect becomes infantilized at that point, and the contractor becomes parental. And what I've been trying to do over the years is to reverse that. And when I have reversed that, as we did in Bilbao or at Disney Hall, we actually reversed that. We were in control all the way to the end. The contractors loved it, and it's obvious why, because they knew exactly what they were supposed to do. It was to 7 decimal points of accuracy. They didn't have many change orders because that was that. They tried to find ways. They always try to find change orders, but they didn't win. When they did, after the fact, in Disney Hall, they threw a barrage of them with lawyers at the committee just because they thought they could get away with it. And they didn't win in the courts. They didn't win one dime on change orders. So you can do it. I think that's everybody's happier. The client's happier. The contractor is always, I've found, always happier, because when the client throws to them, says, how do I save money? They don't know what to do. What are they going to do? Screw up some dream of somebody? They don't want to be responsible for doing that. They don't want to be the bad guys. So I think the precision is important. And I don't know how many of you are in the profession or have been involved with the profession of architecture or building, but it would be better for everyone if the architect took more responsibility than they do. And the only way they can is by having a legal construct that that supports that, and an insurance construct that supports that. And we've made some headway with that. That's like turning the Queen Mary around. But it is possible, and I think it's going to go there. And I think one of the reasons is that the bloody computer, which I don't know how to turn on, but I have a separate company with 100 people, separate from my architect, and they know what to do, and I don't even go in the room where they work. I think I'm going to get eaten up by this thing. But it does eliminate a lot of the junk about it, and that company does work for other architects around the world, other projects I don't have anything to do with. It built the bird's nest in Beijing. We did that. At Ground Zero, now they're planning. This is something you don't think about, but can you imagine if all of the buildings at Ground Zero or in a tight place like that started construction at the same time, what would happen on the streets? It would be gridlocked. The materials couldn't be delivered on time. Workers couldn't be delivered. There would be delays, materials sent back, waste, and all that stuff. So they hired our young computer guys to analyze that and develop a system that is a program for how these things can be done in an orderly way so that they don't conflict with each other. And in China, they've done it on major building construction sites where they eliminated the waste that happens in a normal construction site of delivering materials that are prematurely delivered, are damaged on the site, and have to be tossed out. That number normally is more than 10% of them, probably closer to 15% of the materials delivered to the site are trashed. And the client pays for that. So, and then the change order process of the collisions between the different contract subcontractors also is about a 15% hit. So if you can eliminate that stuff, and we've been doing it in China, and it cuts down those construction costs. I didn't come here to talk about that.
No, but I tell you, one of the things that's particularly, or was particularly interesting to me, was that you could be dealing with these larger corporate and business issues at the same time you were trying to imagine something like a Disney Hall or a Bilbao. And it seems to me that when you get frustrated in terms of making all these things work, you know, government agency slows you down or there's money shortage or whatever, what do you do to keep inspiration going to sort of...
I go to concerts.
No, he does. He does.
No, I think what I've described is a process. I'm sure no matter what profession any of these people are in, there are similar bits and pieces,
yeah, hurdles and stuff.
Of how you organize your life to make sure that these things, that you're always looking for efficiencies in every business. You're always looking for a creative spirit. They're always looking for new ideas. You have to keep your eye on the world around you. I mean, I just heard the word Twitter the other day for the first time. I have no idea what that is. it's fast, too. It's going around. But I think everybody in their own realm probably thinks, if they're successful at it, they probably think and do a lot of the same things I'm talking about in their realm.
Well, how would this apply to museums, let's say?
You want to talk about arts, and I want to talk about technology. See, we're just...
Okay, so we're just going to have a mano a mano here on the stage.
I love Barbara. I always like throwing her off her track. That's the most fun I had on this whole thing. She'd come in prepared to talk about some project, and I'd say, I don't feel like that.
It was really hard, too, because I would spend like, I don't know, a week. I would learn absolutely everything there was to learn about Bilbao for what I assumed was going to be our discussion of Bilbao. Even when I came back from Bilbao, we didn't talk about Bilbao. And then I'd get to the office, and he would want to talk about something that had happened that morning on another project, or something that had happened that had nothing to do with architecture. But we'd eventually get to it. And also, the digressions were so much fun and so interesting.
Well, I always like to talk about new things, okay? So we just entered a competition for the Eisenhower, right? Dwight D. Eisenhower. And I stopped entering competitions because that's a lot of the younger people do it, and that's the way people get work when they're young. And I've stayed, but things are slow now, so we got all these guys and gals in the office, so we entered it. And it's in Washington, D.C., and I was in the 3rd Army, Infantry Division, 3rd Army headquarters in Georgia, and Eisenhower was president, so he was my commander-in-chief. I didn't really spend much time thinking about him way back then. And I thought about his, he was a likable figure. And he did some interesting things, like he won the war. But I didn't know really I didn't really get into thinking about it. When we entered the competition, I started reading everything I could find about this guy. And I realized that, holy cow, this guy, we almost lost that war. This little old story, but he had two letters in his Eisenhower jacket. One saying how desperately sorry he was to have lost this war, and the other one was how overjoyed he was to have won the war. And he had them both going in. The way he dealt with MacArthur, Patton, all those guys, Churchill, which was a difficult one for him. He was a tough guy, Eisenhower, very tough. And how do you characterize this guy? How do you find a way to represent him in Washington, D.C.? How do you make a memorial for somebody like that? The memorials I've seen in D.C. are one of them done by my friend, Larry Halpern, for Roosevelt. It's a nice garden and some nice bronze statues, but it doesn't have the kind of hit that you get when you see the Lincoln Memorial. And none of the new ones, except Maya's Vietnam thing, does have that. But so How do you do that? So, and they gave us a site with a street going through, and there's lots of funny buildings, and we're the backside of the Air and Space Museum and all that. And that really fascinated me. I really got into this thing. I'm not allowed to really explain what we did, but because it hasn't been public. But we won the thing, and I've been meeting with the commission. And the one thing I did, and I don't know if it's going to work, it was just absolutely intuitive. I brought Robert Wilson into our team. And the jury asked me, why you bring him? And I said, well, Bob has I watched him as an actor play Hamlet and Ophelia. You know, and he did it with me once. He stood in front of me and he was Hamlet. And then he moved a foot over here and he became Ophelia. And it was very credible. And I thought, what we really need in this, to do this thing, is for somebody who understands how to develop a character visually. And it's an expertise I don't have. And I thought he would be, and I think the jury, the people on the jury were fascinated with that, because they are also, when we won it, after we won it, we met with some of them, and they are also struggling with that idea. How do you get the essence of this guy? You can't build a statue like Lincoln. It's in a traffic zone. How do you do that? And I want to make a huge tapestry out of metal. And I'm playing with that idea. And you can, we vetted it, we discovered that you can, that there are machinery to do metal weaving and create a tapestry. And this morning I was at Pace Wildenstein in New York, and I saw Chuck Close's beautiful tapestries in black and white. So I called him, asked him to teach us how to do it. But that's the kind of, so I get excited about these things, which is like, I'm not sure where I'm going, and I'm not sure where it's going to end up. For all I know, the Washington guys don't even like the goddamn tapestry idea. they haven't told me yet, but if they don't do it, I'm going to do it somewhere, and it doesn't have to be Ike. I can do Obama.
Well, at this point, we wanted to open the floor to questions, and it would be helpful if you could, if you have a question, raise your hand and they'll bring a microphone to you. So there are a couple of hands up. This woman here.
Hi. At the AGO, right as you come in, there's a maze, which is a delight. Does it have a utilitarian purpose?
That maze?
No, first say the AGO is the...
Art Gallery of Ontario.
Yeah.
Toronto. First museum I ever went to in my life at 8 years old. There's a long story about that. It might take another half hour. You ready? The patron of that museum was Ken Thompson, who died mid-project. Besides giving them a Canadian collection, besides giving them a whole ton of money, he was enamored with his ship's collection. He had model ships, and they're very beautiful. And museum directors don't get excited about hearing somebody putting their model ships in a fancy art museum. And Matthew Teitelbaum and the board were not excited about that. So, but my experience as a kid with museums is that if you're a kid, you go to a museum, I went to the Rome, Royal Ontario Museum as a kid, and I got excited about the mummies. And I used to go back and look at the goddamn mummies. And I'd take my friends, because that was scary, and we'd go look at the mummy. But we did look at the other parts of the museum, and it got us involved with the rest of it. because we were there. And so I said to everybody, why don't we make a beautiful ship's gallery downstairs, but you want to be able to see it when you come in. The kids coming in with their parents should say, oh, ah. And so I made this maze ramp that has holes downstairs to the thing. That's the reason.
This gentleman right here.
Yes, I'd be very interested in hearing you talk about the individual project that you've done that you learned the most from. What was the best learning experience or educational experience?
They all are. I think the most complex project to do is a concert hall. It involves a lot of stuff, when you go into it, it seems very complex. We slowly demystified it; it became a lot simpler. But the mystique of acoustic—I mean, there's so much mystique about things. The same thing with an art museum: the mystique about what's the right kind of room to hang art in, and the stupid world out there thinks it's white boxes. And all of Chelsea is white boxes. And MoMA is white boxes. And most museums are white boxes. And concert halls have a similar kind of mystique. And there's a guy who passed away, Russ Johnson, who flogged movable changeable. So don't worry about it. And the boards love that because it's so precarious a thought to... If you build a thing and it's fixed and it doesn't work, oh my God. Now, Russ did the hall here, right? Movable, changeable. The thing wrong with that is that it creates the hall as a variable musical instrument for which there's no history. So the violin has a history, the cello has a history, all the musical instruments. As soon as you start moving stuff, then the only person that knows what to do is Russ. And I used to see him, I saw him, I ran into him in Budapest. I ran into him in Singapore. I ran into him in Lucerne. And I asked him why he's there, and he said, well, I come to adjust the hall. And I said, for every concert? We tracked him for a long time. And we tracked him through the musicians. And it was disconcerting always with musicians because they never knew what setting the hall was in. It was always different. And so they'd come in, and they get to know a place. Really, most musicians can come into a hall and sense it, like Boulez can do it, Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff did Disney Hall without a rehearsal. He walked on stage, Shostakovich 6, dong, and he nailed it while he was conducting. So there's a lot of adjustment, and there's a lot of artistry in that, and the movable, changeable stuff. So. But boards like the movable, changeable stuff because it's seductive. You think, okay, we're not going to get stuck. And they do, in the end, get stuck. I think the end we found that most of the halls that Russ did, they set the ceiling at 15 meters, and it works. So why not? So we went through all that research and all that stuff, and that was interesting. And then we did studied the various repertoires, what's going on in the history of music, what the new music, the old music, the whole thing. And it got simple because you end up that you really need to build this one-room building again, a beautiful room that feels good for the audience to sit in, that feels good for the orchestra to be in. I mean, emotionally, the room. And that the orchestra can hear each other, they play better. And then the connection between orchestra and audience is works. And that you got to spend time to make that work, to do it. I mean, it kind of works here, where if I move closer to the edge, it would be better for me with you. But so all of those issues, and then, and that's what's happened at Disney Hall. All of those things worked. We spent a lot of time making them work. And the sound worked. We had a great guy, acoustician, that played with me. There was no none of this. We were real partners throughout. He asked whatever he asked for. He was Japanese. He would ask for cylinder. Frank's son, could we have like this, you know? And so I came back spherical, and he'd look at me and say, "Oh, very good. Can you do that? Yeah." So it was that kind of going. We had Esa-Pekka Salonen and members of the orchestra working with us. So it's not just serendipitous. It's a lot of work, but that was exciting, and I love classical music, and it's the only building other than my house that I really continue to use after it's finished, because I can't be in Bilbao every week. And I go to a lot of classical concerts, and it's been fun and exciting, enriching, and to spend time and talking to the musicians, finding out what they like and don't like in certain halls. And they're very vocal about it. They talk about it. And I think the proof for Disney Hall is that it's sold out every night. And I'd say 90% of the seats are filled. There are very few no-shows. That means the orchestra's in the black and everything's going good.
Yeah. This woman here is...
Comment on the band shell in Chicago and the challenges that presented in Millennium Park with all the sort of hodgepodge of all the things going on there. Whether that was... you felt that was, you were just one of many, or you were able to operate without thinking about everything else going on there?
Well, I like being one of many. I think it's more of an urban idea. Anish Kapoor is a friend of mine, so it was very easy, and I love the piece he did. It's one of the best things. And Tom Beebe, who did the theater behind me, is an old friend, so we collaborated as much as we could. The people that did the garden, we had meetings. There was a little bit of stridency there on one part. But the mayor was incredible, Rich Daley. I mean, everybody should be blessed with that kind of guy. He was in there. He questioned a lot of my stuff. He's really a guy, an old-fashioned guy. He liked the 19th century better than the 20th century. If he'd have had his way all the way, it would have been a 19th century park. But he was quite willing to, you know, he had donors, the Pritzker family and so on. He had to respect. And he was great to play with. The have you been to a concert? Even so, the idea was to have the 15,000 people sitting on the lawn wherever they were have a good sound experience from, and the original sound we could control pretty well. We could make a shell that we knew we could get a balanced orchestral sound from it. The hard thing is to project it 300 or 400 feet out into the boondocks and have somebody sitting on a blanket out there hear it. The options, the best option was the distributed speakers, distributed sound system. And it's used in a lot of places. You maybe may have experienced it, but sometimes in courthouses and in legislative chambers and places like that. It's a time delay system, a computerized time delay system. And you need to put speakers every 40 or 50 feet or so on a grid to distribute it evenly. And they usually put them on poles. So it would have been a forest of poles. And I like the idea of making a trellis, and the trellis sort of framed the outdoor space and gave you the sense that it was a building. So it was an enclosure. And I thought that was a rather important thing to do in the middle of Chicago, to create a place where you felt you were in something even though you weren't. And so the trellis was the way of hanging the speakers. So that's all it does. It hangs the speakers and visually creates that thing. It could have been designed for a fabric to be pulled over it. It was a $3 million extra that was value engineered out. And after the fact, you can't do it. The engineering of the materials, you can't do it. But for a while, we fussed about how do you, because it rains in Chicago occasionally. But they haven't had that much trouble with it. Anyway.
Okay, let's take another question. This woman right here.
Yeah. Woman right here.
I know that means nothing right here, but I did the hand gesture.
Thank you for sharing it with us so much. I have a two-part question.
Uh-oh.
The first one, you told us when you were studying, a teacher thought you should not become an architect. What gave you the strength? What were your dreams that broke the ice and you were able to continue? The second part of the question is, if money was not a problem, what would be the dream of what you would like to leave, something you haven't yet done for humanity? No matter where in the world, or where in the world would you like to do something like that?
Are you ready to commission it?
Why not?
When the guy called me in and told me that, I was already hooked. I was so dedicated to architecture. It didn't matter. I told him when he told me that, I said, "You're too late." I said, I'm sticking it out. If you want to help, teach me. If you don't, I'll find somebody else. I have a superstitious streak. I don't really ever yearn for a project because you never get them, and then you're so damn frustrated. So I just wait. I haven't missed out on much. You know, I've always thought, I love flying, so I'd like to do an airport sometime, but I worked on one when I was a kid working for somebody else, but I like sailing, so I wanted to design a sailboat, and somebody hired me to do one. What else do I do? I don't remember.
Okay, so we'll take two more questions. This man here, and the woman here on the other side.
With regard to your art museum project, do you find it liberating or disappointing that there would appear to be little opportunity for external display?
Well, I found it intriguing. In fact, I was here, it was right after Bilbao, and I'd worked on Bilbao with Gail Harity, who's was Annie's sidekick. And I came to a show, I think it was Barnett Newman's Stations, and we were walking through the show, and at the end they started talking about this expansion of the museum, and it probably had to be underground, and I got really excited about it because, you know, I've already done one above the ground. I thought it would be a great challenge to try to figure out how to do something like that. But that was a few years passed until then they called for people to submit, and I was still interested, so I did, and I got chosen, and now we need a lot of money.
Let's take one last question then.
This is altogether different. The little house at Venice Beach, when I first was aware of it, I must have seen it 35 years ago. Is it still there?
Venice.
Venice Beach on the boardwalk.
The one with the lifeguard?
The one that's red and blue and has the pipe going off the side?
Red and blue.
A little small house. When I thought of it when you said one room. Did you build?
There's a little house I did for Bill Norton, who was a screenwriter, who, when he was a kid, was a lifeguard. And he liked writing. And he was part of the first wave with George Lucas. He worked with Lucas. He wanted to have he fantasized having a lifeguard tower on the beach. So I made him a lifeguard tower, and it's still there. I think he used it for a while, and I don't think he uses it anymore. I think it's not, you know, when he was a kid, it was okay, but now it's not luxurious enough. Doesn't have a. In fact, I told him when we built it, I said we should put a little urinal in the side, buried in, and he never wanted to, so I suspect he doesn't use it that much.
Well, on behalf of everyone in the audience, I want to thank Frank Gehry for giving us the time tonight.
And let's give another round of applause for both Barbara and Frank Gehry. Pleasure to have both of you. And I want to invite all of you up to dessert up in our West Gallery, up on the first floor. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.